Hi, and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. This is a special edition podcast, and my name is Peter Gunry. I'm head of equity strategy with Saxo, and I'm thrilled to do this special podcast with a young guy from Scotland called Conor McNeill. And I stumbled into Conor by a little bit of an accident on Twitter. There's so much information on Twitter, and he happened to pop up in my feed, and something just piqued my interest. And I read about Conor's sort of thoughts and ideas about what he was doing and the journey he had been on for quite a year. And I followed him, and I think he's a very interesting guy, and I like what he's doing. And I wanted to invite him into our podcast to talk about a lot of different things about the research industry, Substack, etc., his newsletter, and a couple of companies. So I really hope you will enjoy this. And Conor, welcome on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Peter. And that was a great introduction, so I appreciate that.
Thank you. But talking about introduction, do you care, you know, spending a little bit of time just, you know, telling a little bit about yourself so the listeners know who Conor is?
Sure. So as you said, my name is Conor McNeill. I'm based in Edinburgh in Scotland. I kind of spent my formative years in Germany and England before, you know, moving back home for secondary education. You know, during this time in that secondary education, I became fascinated with kind of the financial system and business as a whole. You know, I later then studied economics at the undergraduate level, you know, and it was at this time that I discovered, you know, I was more so interested in investing. So, you know, throughout my undergraduate degree, I went through the typical early investor track, if you will, you know, studying Graham and Buffett, as well as making all the classic investing mistakes, you know, along the way. After 4 years of studying economics, my kind of biggest takeaway there was that I didn't want to be an economist. You know, I figured out that I wanted to do something related to investing in my life, but I wasn't sure, you know, what that track would look like. So I took a master's in innovation at the same university to kind of bide my time. Concurrently, I then started the CFA designation and then kind of accidentally stumbled into a full-time job as an analyst for a fintech company, you know, more so on the fin side. So I was doing all that at once, and I did that for a few years. And in February 2020, I started a Twitter account to share kind of ideas, research, and connect with other investors. My social circle at the time that was interested in investing was quite small. So this was kind of the impetus to me to, you know, reach out and find others. I then stumbled into a quote unquote creative role after writing a kind of a beginner's guide to understanding financial statements, just purely funneled through Twitter. About a month or two after that, I launched a newsletter because I kind of discovered that I enjoy writing and wanted to do it more frequently in a different kind of format. And, you know, a year after that, in March 2020, I was able to leave my full-time job to start writing on Substack full-time. And, you know, today that's what I'm still doing. I'm, you know, writing an investment newsletter called Investment Talk, but I'm also spending a small portion of my time, you know, working at a Series A startup based in the States as well.
Thank you. It's a great journey. It's an interesting story you have, Conor. And as I said to you before, we did this podcast. My boss said that we should only listen to people under 40. So you definitely fit that characteristic. And so it's good to get your perspective. And you talked about your newsletter in Investment mm-hmm. Talk, which sits on Substack. And one of the reasons why. And one of the conversations I want to have with you is this Substack, because it's not only you that is on Substack. To me, looking from the outside, you know, I write my research through Saxo, and we have our different channels. But this Substack and your Investment Talk newsletter fits into, as I see it, like a growing independent research group of independent minds, and to a large extent, you know, exactly what the Europe. Or the EU wanted out of the MiFID II regulation. And I mean, why Substack? What is it, and why is it so good? And can you tell us a little bit about this whole group that you're actually part of?
Yeah, so I'll kind of spin that back and give you some context as to, you know, why I came up with the idea, and, you know, a bit about kind of my start there, and then I'll jump into kind of talk about what the company itself is offering. You know, and kind of whether or not I think that's maybe transformational to the research industry as a whole. So when I first came to Twitter, you know, back in early 2020, I found, you know, there were a lot of newer investors there that I was communicating with that, you know, didn't know how to do something as basic as read a balance sheet. So at the time, my company went working from home, so I had plenty of free time. You know, I wrote a beginner's guide that I mentioned. It was about 190 pages in length. And it really just, you know, kind of the nuts and bolts of how to read the three core financial statements. And the demand there was, you know, really strong. So that was the kind of light bulb for me, like, you know, considering myself more of a creative person and, you know, there's an educational demand there. So that kind of sparked something in me. And mostly it kind of opened up the potential to make this a, you know, a compelling secondary role or job doing something that I really love, because I was writing about this stuff in Google Docs long before I ever shared it publicly. About a month or two later, I then started the newsletter so I could share thoughts and kind of research a bit more fluidly. You know, by July, there was 1,000 readers. By the end of 2020, there was about 3,500 readers. You know, and by the end of this year, I should reach somewhere around 6,500 total readers. So I was very fortunate, and something that should be stated first, you know, by the beginning of 2021, I was, you know, earning enough to pay for rent, bills, some minor living expenses. But if I just jumped ship at that point, the quality of my living would have declined dramatically. You know, I was quite happy maintaining a full-time job and writing on the side. I hadn't really planned to maybe leave my job until later in 2022. So Substack approached me early 2021 and offered me a Substack Pro deal. And, you know, without boring with all the details, what this essentially does is upfronts you a projected kind of dollar amount of revenue. And what it really does is just mitigates your risk. So at that point, I thought, you know, I can survive for maybe 1.5 to 2 years just from the proceeds of that deal. You know, so I quit my job the same day, which, you know, for anyone that's ever quit their job, you know, it's an amazing feeling. I did like my job, but it was an amazing feeling to take kind of a leap into the dark, you know, whilst I'm still young and can afford to make those risks. So I've really enjoyed that so far and, you know, found it's improved everything that I'm doing. So with Substack as a whole, you know, I would start by saying that I think it is transformational to far more than the financial research industry. Obviously I'm focused on the investment kind of research angle, but, you know, writing online, blogging, chat boards, these things have been around for decades and some people have built up quite a big following, and even turned that into kind of a business. But Substack has, you know, made it so easy to set up a newsletter or a blog or kind of whatever you want it to be. It's highly accessible to everyone. You know, prior to that, you would likely have to have had some kind of technical chops to be able to build and manage some kind of website. So even right there, that's a barrier to entry for someone that's maybe a bit more inept at technology. So Substack breaking down that hump or kind of intimidation factor has really helped with their success. You know, this is true for any subject matter, whether it be political, investing, cooking, yeah, you name it. So the core value proposition is that it's easy to set up almost instantly. You know, you own your audience and you can then monetize that audience within minutes by using Stripe, their chosen payments integration. You know, and it's proven to be very successful. I think in March 2020, they had around 100,000 paid subscribers total on the site. You know, 1 year later, that was 500,000. That's the most accurate data I have right now. I don't know what it is right now, but I'd consider it to be, you know, a lot higher than that. With regards to the research industry, you know, it simply opens up the opportunity to everyone that wishes to publicly share their research. You know, within that, there are hundreds of niches that a writer can focus on. I've seen successful research newsletters in the space that purely just focus on proxy filings and maybe any alpha from there, but also kind of with an educational tint. You know, I've seen people focus just purely on corporate misconduct, people that focus purely on short opportunities. And then the bulk from what I find is mainly kind of long form equity research. And even within just that bracket alone, you have investors who are writing about Japanese, Chinese, European, US, British equities, all specializing in that niche that you as a reader are potentially interested in. So most importantly, you know, it's accessible to everyone. Everyone can read it and everyone can write about it. I would add here that, you know, if any of your listeners want to see how this trend of kind of fragmenting the research industry has done particularly well, I'll kind of run over a few best in class examples that I think you should check out. So Alex Morris, who writes The Science of Hitting, he wrote for decades on a kind of chat board place called Guru Focus prior, and he was also an investment analyst at the time working at a fund. He writes about stocks he owns, but also portfolio management in a way that's kind of like outsourcing an analyst. There's a guy called Abdullah who writes mostly borrowed ideas. He writes purely just one high quality report on a new company each month. You know, it's objective. The framing is excellent and the quality is as high as I've seen from any institution. You have David Kim who writes Scuttleblub. He's kind of the OG in this space and has inspired a lot of people like Abdullah to then go and build a business doing the same thing. You know, and lastly, there's others, really interesting people like Liberty RFP, who is anonymous, but I've met him before. He's a great guy. He basically curates content with added commentary, covering kind of everything from investing in business to science and technology to the arts and history, you know, and he sends that out twice a week. And honestly, ever since I've been reading a lot more kind of Substacks, my kind of consumption of mainstream media has kind of declined because I'm getting all this interesting, insightful information from this handful of Substacks that I'm reading. And it's, you know, it's really interesting.
But that's also one of the reasons why, and I'm glad you mentioned all the others, because I wanted to highlight you. And now you mentioned some of the other very interesting persons to follow on Substack within the investment field, because, you know, Saxo clients, you know, there is a distrust, I think, that have come out of the financial crisis towards the financial industry in terms of the research that come out. And a lot of the traditional banks, they have corporate finance relationships, so they can't be as brutally honest as they probably should be in many cases. So that's why I think this independent research is so valuable to everyone, not only Saxo clients. So I'm super happy that you're sharing this. And just quickly before we talk a little bit about your investment approach. So I can see on Substack, you pay $15 a month for your for your newsletter. Can you just briefly talk a little bit about what do I get from Connor if I subscribe to your newsletter?
Sure. So in a nutshell, the bulk of what I share is equity research. I would say that's probably about 90% of the content. I write about companies that I own with some commentary around portfolio management there as well. Sharing positions, you know, this can include outlining my thesis for getting or remaining long, you know, commentary around quarterly earnings of the companies that I hold. To keep things fresh, I also write about one new company each month. These tend to be a bit longer and a bit more in depth. And in those issues, I take the reader through everything from the history of the business to understanding how it functions in the present day, you know, where it's positioned in the market, who the competitors are, you know, what that market structure looks like, what the management team history is like, you know, what are their incentives? You can find out by reading proxies, the financials, you know, and throughout that, I'm kind of peppering my own thoughts, but aiming to do so in an objective way. It's not necessarily that I actually own the stock I'm talking about in those cases. So I try to remain objective as if I was kind of doing my own research process. Aside from that, I occasionally do interviews with other investors. I write about more high level topics like my process for selling, how I view conviction. And then each Sunday I share kind of a curated batch of the most interesting research pieces and other articles that I've read from other investors or funds throughout the week, which is quite popular. And for paid subscribers, so I have paid and freed. For paid subscribers, I also manage kind of an informal community chat room where they can all connect and talk. I created this kind of as a result of feedback from several readers and have since found it to be one of the most valuable aspects for me personally.
Thanks. I think it, when you look through your newsletter and what you're doing, I think it's pretty amazing. And if you couple your newsletter together with some of the others, I think you get a pretty interesting bundle. As you said, you can nowadays, there's so much rich information you can get without, you know, necessarily having some of the expensive traditional media subscriptions or even a Bloomberg terminal. It's fascinating what is going on. Connor, I want to take the listener into your thoughts, because we're going to talk about two companies that you you highlighted to me, which could be interesting topics. But before we go to that, we need to talk a little bit about your investment approach. You mentioned that you started almost like myself, you know, reading Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett. It just seems natural. It's the classic way into investment. Can you go a little bit through what's your approach? What are you looking for when you look at companies to potentially invest in?
For sure, yeah. I think everyone starts there for some reason. Most people I speak to either start from like a technical perspective and are reading things like Mark Minervani, or they're starting with Graham and Buffett, and you know, that kind of school of thought. I think for myself, I don't really follow that creed, but the kind of mental aspects of investing that Graham taught really stuck with me. So I kind of like that. So from a very high level, I'm a long biased investor that typically takes a kind of a 3 to 5 year outlook with each position I take. You know, ideally you would hold it longer than that, but you know, for the initial kind of input of capital, it's 3 to 5 years outlook. And that's what the thesis is based on. And then you're kind of reaffirming that throughout. And then at the end of that period, you're going to check where you're sitting to avoid kind of thesis creep, as it were. So something else to consider here before I kind of ramble on is that, you know, I'm definitely in the accumulation phase, given my age and my total time horizon and the structure of my personal kind of financial situation. You know, I'm not working with a fixed base of capital here. I contribute to my portfolio on a, you know, on a quarterly basis. So the first thing for me is understanding. The primary goal is finding an investment thesis that I can understand in a market structure that I can understand. And, you know, when things are changing, I kind of am more abreast as to what that means for the constituents of that market, as it were. So I like to imagine 3 circles of competence, you know, not a new concept by any means. So the smallest ring, or the nucleus, as it were, would be kind of my core competency. So this is things that I'm comfortable with. I understand the market structure, the consumers, the competitors, and the potential investments, you know, place in that market. So where they're kind of situated relative to competitors. You know, when some external force kind of hits that market, it's more likely that I can understand the consequences and be informed as to, you know, what the next steps are. So the second kind of outer layer is what I refer to as the learning circle. And this is something that I picked up from Ian Castle at Intelligent Fanatics. So this area is kind of a market that I'm somewhat familiar with, but I'm still, you know, in the learning phase, not entirely comfortable with it so far. So, you know, say I have a solid understanding of how coffee chains function globally through following Starbucks and a number of other companies over the years. Now say that I'm looking at kind of a sushi chain, a domestic sushi chain in the US, which is kind of similar. You know, the business model is not too dissimilar. They're not directly comparable, nor is the market for coffee and sushi. So the sushi chain might be something that I can relate to, but not yet fully understand. So that's kind of where I would situate that in my kind of thought process. So I mostly stick to those 2 areas to find ideas. The kind of third outer layer there would be populated with areas of the market that I just know nothing about. And it would require a great step up in kind of research to pull them into that learning circle. So they're on the horizon, and ideally I would pull them in over time, but you know, they're not a priority. So the types of firms that I'm looking at, I'm definitely agnostic towards labeling myself as a value or a growth investor. I don't really care what the business or their respective shareholders are labeled as either. If I had to create kind of 3 broad buckets of quote unquote opportunities, I would frame them as leaders with wide moats, future market leaders, and then something that I would call interesting situations. So a leader with a wide moat is a company that I've identified as kind of a market leader in their field, you know, and they're showing limited signs of that lead slipping over the next 5 to 10 years. They most often have some form of protective moat, you know, whether it be through a cost advantage, a superior business model, regulatory, you know, branding, product, or in some cases, stellar management, because, you know, in some cases, the bet that you're making rests heavier on the management's shoulders than other bets that you're making. Now, a future market leader would typically be in an industry that is currently being disrupted. So if you think of a leader with a wide moat, you have coffee, you have Starbucks. You give someone $10 billion, like Buffett says, I think it would be hard to kind of disrupt that brand. And there's no kind of promising people or companies, entities that are doing that right now. There's some smaller ones, but you know, nothing too consequential. So in a future market leader kind of bracket, you're looking at an industry like payments, for example, you know, where there's a lot of disruption there and a lot of opportunity for smaller companies. So whether these companies are growing at maybe 100% annually or 35% annually, it doesn't really matter to me. If there's a business in that cohort that I think has the potential to carve out market share for years to come, maybe taking some of the incumbents down along the way, then I'm prepared to get long for that ride. So I'm often less sensitive to price and volatility here, you know, as I feel that quality is sometimes worth paying for. So, you know, for instance, something like Square, which I was very much interested in pre-COVID, and it's kind of just gifted me the ability to kind of jump in there in the $60 range when the market turns sour. The last kind of bucket would be interesting situations, which might be a lazy label to kind of just sum up everything that doesn't fit into those other cohorts that I mentioned. You know, typically it's something that has a kind of temporary mispricing or a misunderstanding where I feel there can be some value that's, you know, has the potential to be unlocked there. I don't often allocate a great deal of weight to these ideas, you know, never more so than 8% or more of the total AUM. The time horizon can be considerably shorter, maybe 1 to 3 years. They may be on the outer edges of my learning circle. And, you know, obviously the dispersion of outcomes is likely to be significantly higher. But I like to frame it as if you lose, you lose small. If you win, you know, you win big. In terms of the process, you know, after identifying a company that kind of, you know, tickles my interest or ticks these boxes, the process is quite mundane and quite boring. I don't have any edge here. I start with a 10K. At this point, I can usually tell if I'm interested after reading that. I then proceed to investigate management, you know, read earnings calls, read previous 10Q filings, watch interviews, and seek to understand kind of the accounting and the business model. You know, following that, I'll then, if I'm still interested, examine the industry as a whole. You know, at this point, it can be another source of idea generation because, you know, realistically, you can discover competitors that you feel are more attractive, and that's a bit of lead gen there for ideas. After I've done that, I might look to build out a fairly basic five-year model of where I think the business could be at that point in time. And kind of see if that matches my expectations or what the market is expecting. I will then reach out to my network, which thankfully through Twitter has grown tremendously over the last couple of years, and see if anyone has their own thoughts. I'll read external research, all in an aid to kind of cross-check my own work or assumptions and see if I'm missing anything. So my process is not the most efficient or exciting, but it ensures that I'm soaking up a lot of quality information along the way. If something, you know, turns out to be a dead end, it doesn't bother me so much because, you know, I'm growing my basket of studied companies, which will come in handy for years to come. Valuation is often the last piece of the puzzle in my process, which, you know, might sound counterintuitive. You know, if something turns out to be expensive, then I've wasted my time. Yeah, so that's how it goes. I like to think on the kind of reverse of that and, you know, think that you can't judge how expensive a business is on valuation alone, you know, without context, i.e. the whole process that I just explained, you know, then you're just looking at numbers. So sometimes companies command higher valuations, but, you know, most of the time they don't deserve that. So my point being is, how are you supposed to know if they deserve it without taking a peek under the hood? You know, and just lastly, before I finish, I think circling back to the idea of, you know, there are no wasted research efforts. I think in the environment of maybe a fund or a research firm, yes, that might not be true. But for an individual like myself, that's, you know, certainly true, which is, I think, the differentiator between institutional and then maybe like Substack or WordPress type research. The analyst has the time to pursue potentially dead end ideas and learn from that. So one way that I expand my own investing circle, if you were, is through the practice of just studying one new company in depth each month. Routinely. So if you think after one full year, I would have explored a minimum of 12 entirely new companies in depth. After 10 years, that's going to be 120 new companies at the bare minimum. As you begin to study kind of more companies, there will eventually be positive spillover effects whereby your studies over the past few years will enable you to better understand future research products. And as you progress, you'll eventually kind of create a mini mental database of, you know, anywhere from 50 to 100 companies that you know really well. It's not simply enough to know your own portfolio well. It's a huge advantage if you can understand a larger range of businesses to the extent that you can revisit a business quarters or years later and already have a rough idea of where you are. Might be some kind of small catch-up period there, but the base understanding is, you know, is already there. So I would say that's kind of my thoughts. Yeah.
I think it sounds pretty thorough. I've written some things down. It's about having a process. I think with my experience, it's not necessarily always a good idea. I mean, some of my best investments have been absolute accidents that I just stumbled into by, you know, one of them was reading in the Wall Street Journal about carbon capture. And then I just happened to have 5 minutes to look up the Bloomberg terminal for companies with exposure to carbon capture. I only found one company out of 40,000 in the world, and that was a pure play out of Norway. so sometimes you know, things happen by luck. And I think it was also interesting you said that with you don't have an edge, because I'm reading this book Expecting Investing from Michael Mabosan. He's a very great writer and a very, very great thinker on equities. And he says the same thing, that we all have access, unless you're an insider and trades on insider information, we all have access to the same information. So it's all about the way we interpret that information. Mm-hmm. And I think that is where you edge it. So, and I think your whole process sounds pretty thorough to me. And it sounds like you're pretty unbiased. I mean, you don't put a label specifically on you. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in a value investor or I have growth. It seems like you have a pretty agnostic way of looking at investments.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to be for me personally. Like, investing is so much about fitting what you're doing with your own personality. I find it helps you sleep better at night, so that's kind of how I survive that.
All right, we need to talk about some companies, because I asked you, so what are your biggest convictions, and what companies do you really want to talk about? And you came back with a couple of names, and one of them I had never heard about before. The other one I had heard about. So let's start with the first one, which is you really need to explain, because I'm not sure I see the case. So, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have never heard about this company. So it's called PLBY Group. Yeah. It's a short name for I think Playboy, right? And it's one of their main assets. It came to the market via a SPAC. Can you tell a little bit? So how did you come about this company? And sure. Maybe tell a little bit about why did they come to the stock exchange, and why through a SPAC and all these things?
Sure. So I'll give more insight into like what the company is doing now in just a moment. But in terms of SPAC, so I'm sure some of your listeners will know, it's just a special purpose acquisition company, you know, often referred to as kind of a blank check company, in that it's a public entity acting almost as kind of an empty shell with cash sitting inside of it. And, you know, it's going to be looking to make a deal to acquire some kind of business within 2 years. So that's a very simplified answer, but essentially it's just an alternative path to taking the traditional IPO route. Often there's more focus on the future instead of kind of sharing what they've been doing over the past, you know, 2 or 3 years. In a normal IPO, I think the regulatory setting is a lot more lax in that environment as well. So for PLBY Group, the SPAC was Mountain Crest Acquisition Corp. And with regards to why they chose that route, I can actually quote Ben Cohn here, and I'll just run this off. But he said, it's a very efficient way to raise capital. For us, we had been capital starved with no money to invest in the business. We now have capital to invest and hopefully accelerate both our organic and inorganic growth. A SPAC deal allows you to talk to investors under NDA and gauge interest. A little more dilution, but in my opinion, for us, it was worth it, as most people did not realize the evolution of the business. He then continues to say, a lot of people still think we are a magazine company. You know, being public actually helps us educate investors on what we are today. Just takes time as people come in with a preconceived notion. So that was his thoughts back in early 2021. And as to where I found the company, it's very interesting that you, when I talked about process, and then you said, you know, sometimes ideas just pop out of nowhere. You know, I forgot to mention that. It's certainly true. Having a large following on Twitter can be very helpful for idea generation. Occasionally, I will just send out a tweet asking people, you know, what their most interesting small cap ideas are between, you know, maybe $1 billion and $5 billion. And there was this one particular tweet that got maybe over 250 responses. And out of all those responses, there was one tweet that had a short paragraph pitch about PLBY. And it's just the kind of company or kind of opportunity that sparks my interest is something, you know, like in that kind of third bucket that I mentioned earlier, which is interesting situations. So there was kind of a preconceived notion that, and even I had this, that Playboy was still just a magazine company with that kind of lingering Hugh Hefner brand attached to them. But the reality is quite different. So for those of listeners that don't know, Playboy was a public company once upon a time, and they were taken private, I think, in the early 2010s by a private equity firm, which Ben Cohen, the now CEO, was current, you know, was a partner at. And they lay dormant private for a number of years, you know, kind of twiddling their thumbs with their media business. And Ben Cohen had this kind of idea to turn it into an apparel business, you know, focusing more on licensing and distributing direct to consumer sales through apparel and whatnot. And then he became the CEO a number of years later and was, you know, kind of instrumental in taking them back to the public markets. But when they landed, you know, when they became public after that SPAC deal, you know, a lot of people's perceptions were still, you know, this is a Hugh Hefner affiliated magazine company. I particularly remember one, I won't name them, one fund manager who responded to my initial kind of tweet when I was interested in researching more, saying, you know, this brand is dead with Hugh Hefner gone, which I don't know if that was an age thing, but in my mind, the brand is actually a lot better off without Hugh Hefner because it removes a lot of those kind of ties that, you know, negative associations that he kind of brought into that brand.
Yeah, I actually think you're right about that assessment actually. So I had never heard about anything about this this company before, and I looked into the numbers, and you say it's not in it's not the magazine business any longer, but they hold the IP rights to Playboy, and I think that's one of the avenues or the paths to, you know, higher operating margins, which is one of the key value drivers of any business. And I looked at it, and so the analysts that are covering the company are expecting revenue for next fiscal year 2022 to reach 337 million, and that's a pretty steep increase and a margin of around 19% on an EBITDA margin basis. I looked at the valuations. I mean, it's trading at an earnings yield, not that that's necessarily the best measure, but just that's the concept most people can understand. So around a little bit more than 5%, and they have a pretty, I think it looks like they have a pretty decent growth trajectory on the top line. So within those numbers and what I just said, I mean, what's your thesis? Where can they continue to grow and will be a high growth company, or is it more that they can expand margins, and where's the value in the business?
Sure. So you know, based on the kind of case that you put there, it just sounds too good to be true. But some important things to kind of bear in mind here for your listeners in terms of like management. So PLBY Group for me is a very small position. It's maybe 3%. I wouldn't allow it to grow to something a bit more sizable, you know, upwards of 6 to 8%. I'd likely be truing it back there because the dispersion of outcomes here based on the execution risk is particularly high. But I myself found it to be an interesting situation, you know, with a potential for some upside there due to the misunderstanding. More context, the price ran up significantly after the SPAC deal, pure speculation in my opinion. I doubled down at a market cap of around $900 million. That's kind of where I see some kind of fair value there based on the opportunity. So yeah, it sounds too good to be true, but you have to consider that most of this growth or the leap from 2021 to 2022 is inorganic. So in 2021, they acquired a company called Honey Birdette, which is a fast-growing, high-margin lingerie brand based in Australia, which is where most of the revenue comes from. They branched out to the US, but PLBY are repositioning that to kind of aim it at the much larger, more affluent US kind of user base there. So this Honey Birdette deal only adds a modest amount of top line in 2021, maybe somewhere around the $30 million range, you know, but next year in 2022, it should be, at least in my model, around $95 million, somewhere thereabouts. So that's, you know, a considerable jump on a company, you know, that's earning about $225 million of revenue this year. So additional context, the Playboy business, which exists today, you know, it runs a high margin licensing business. As you said, it runs a fledgling but kind of fast growing DTC business, direct to consumer. And it has a number of other call options in there, like digital subscriptions, other bets. NFTs, which I think is purely a free call option there. I don't know what that's valued at. Right now, the direct-to-consumer business is roughly 50% of that revenue base, mostly inorganic growth there, with licensing in the mid-30s, digital in the kind of 10s range, and then other is a small fraction. So last quarter, Lance, the CEO, said something interesting. Playboy, when they went public, had a 2025 revenue target of $300 million. And he said last quarter that they would be doubling this to $600 million. He said that by, you know, and the market reaction wasn't amazing, and I'm about to explain why that might be the case. So he said that growing licensing by high single digit and the DTC business by about 20% over the next 4 to 5 years kind of gets you there. So I modeled this out and the results, and, you know, using just purely what Lance said and some kind of modest growth from the other aspects of the business, the most conservative estimate that I had kind of gets you well above $500 million by 2025. You know, and this is without any M&A activity. And it came before they acquired Dream, which is kind of like the technology base that they're going to be using to build out Centerfold, which is like their version of OnlyFans. So even digital subscription has potential to have, you know, explosive upside there if they execute that well. But my point being is that the original $300 million guidance for 2025 was, you know, a bit of a joke. So the market reaction when they doubled it, you know, didn't really do anything, wasn't so surprising. You know, as far as 2020 is concerned, and the figure that you cited, $337 million thereabouts, I have mine slightly lower. I think maybe $320 million is more likely based on those conservative efforts. I've not baked any kind of revenue from Centerfold in there. It's just purely based on what kind of Lance has said, you know, spreading that out over 5 years. So I'm not overly concerned for what 2020 looks like. I prefer to look a little bit more into the distance and kind of see what it looks like there. I told you I doubled down at this kind of certain market cap, and I'm happy to set up camp and wait, provided they continue to execute. But the core thesis for me stands around, you know, a licensing business which is very stable, it's highly cash flow generative, it's high margin. And in the Hefner era, he didn't really care so much for the licensing business. He was more interested in the media business, which is by far the worst business. So the licensing deals they had, which extend multiple years, were quite terrible. So part of the thesis for the licensing business is kind of collecting more cents on each dollar of sales through licensing by renegotiating those contracts. And on the side of that, you have this kind of high growth DTC business where they're actually collecting the full dollar on sales of everything, you know, Playboy apparel branded. They do a lot of sales globally, but they just don't collect a lot of the cents on those dollars right now. And that's something they're kind of looking to change.
It's an interesting case. And I was just doing some back on the envelope calculations. So $500 million in revenue by 25. And to me, an expanding margin trajectory, because that's yeah, always what surprises most, you know, investors that have a typical value orientation, is that the magic on compounding of the value, shareholder value creation, by having, you know, 15 to 20% top line growth rate, but then also expanding operating margins, and what that does to your free cash flow. And I can see on the numbers for the company that they don't spend outside the acquisitions they've done, the ordinary capital expenditures that needs to go into the business, mm-hmm, and also increase in working capital is quite minimal relative to how much they can actually increase their sales. So it seems like there's a lot of shareholder value drivers in this company going forward.
Yeah, I would agree, but then execution risk, obviously. So yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to talk about, you know, how does this with their brand and their lifestyle, whether they could actually expand into other channels there. But we're probably running out of time because we need to get to the next company. Unfortunately, we can't talk all day, although I find these discussions interesting. We need to talk about Match Group. It's another company you brought into the realm and of this discussion. It's probably the largest group of brands within the dating industry, mm-hmm, which have been a high growth industry for what, 2 decades, maybe, maybe a little bit even longer. And can you tell us a little bit about how did it come about Match Group, and what's your expectations and your sense? What's the sort of, where do you see the value in Match Group?
Sure. So I've been following Match Group for a number of years. As an early kind of, well, a young man, I used Tinder when I was growing up at university, as I'm sure many do. That was kind of coinciding with my interest in investing. So I was like, I love this product. It's great. I wonder if there's a company that kind of owns that. I discovered Match Group. It was still with IAC at that point. So yeah, that's kind of how I discovered it. I think maybe 2017, 2018, somewhere around there. So my assumptions for Match Group kind of going forward, you're right, it's in this oligopoly. It's by far the biggest and strongest portfolio there, with a number of emerging, established, and kind of the flagship, which is just obviously Tinder. They've kind of guided for, they usually guide for mid to high teens revenue growth every year. And sometimes they sit in there. This year, they obviously beat that. They're expected to do about 25%, you know, no doubt probably helped slash hindered by COVID in many other different ways. But for the next 5 years, I'm probably thinking mid to high teens, you know, revenue growth over that period. You know, they're still fairly early in monetizing the majority of their users. You know, prior to their change of disclosure, they made disclosure a lot better for geographics. They used to tout ARPU, and that was in the 50-cent range. Now they cite revenue per payer, per paying person, in the $16 range, kind of as of the most recent quarter, which was Q3. The entire portfolio currently has about 16 million paying users, and you know, about just maybe about half of those, about 8 million of those, are on Tinder. So I'm not sure, you know, if we reach saturation anytime soon, but I know that it will certainly happen in the West before it does in the East in terms of users, but not ARPU. I still think we're very early in that stage, because although the stigma of online dating has definitely died in the West, less so in the East, I think the stigma of paying to use online dating services still lingering in the West. You know, so if you ask some people, oh, have you ever subscribed to use Tinder? You know, they'll maybe throw a funny face at you and say, why would I pay to do that? But the reality is that the experience is much better if you pay for a month's subscription. And, you know, slowly people are kind of realizing that. You know, aside from adding new users as well, the company are now kind of experimenting with new funnels of revenue streams, you know, virtual currency, VR, and kind of interactive live media to spur engagement and thus increase propensity to pay. But, you know, aside from revenue, I think the most important thing with Match Group right now, which wasn't admittedly baked into my original thesis, it's kind of like gravy over the beef. Two things that spring to mind, just purely based on margin expansion. So we saw Google reduce their App Store fee for subscription products from 30% to 15%. Effective as of January 1st or the end of January 1st or the end of January in 2022. And for Tinder, this is for Match Group, this is huge, because that's around 70% of their revenue base. And the second point there, cost savings, potential margin expansion, is the Hyperconnect business, which they acquired earlier this year. In my opinion, mostly for the technology and the human capital, they're kind of in the process of a multi-year effort to kind of consolidate all of their third-party data providers and technology providers just purely into using Hyperconnect technology. And obviously there's going to be a lot of efficiencies that flow out of that, some of which are going to be cost savings, you know, and there's potential for margin expansion there. So whether or not the revenue growth is 15% or 20% CAGR over the next 5 years, I think margin expansion potential there, you know, has the potential to kind of make up for that.
Yeah, I can. I was just looking at the Bloomberg consensus estimates, and so in the last 12 months they have an EBITDA adjusted margin around just slightly below 32%, and you know, the estimates for 25, so 5 years ahead from now, is or 4 years if you will, 41%. So oh, and wow. Yeah, so it seems like your thesis on the margin expansion is very much the one that is being played by analysts. And again, when I look at what they need to put into the business in terms of CapEx to really drive revenue growth, you can just see that this is a company that creates immense amount of value. Are you two questions? Are you worried about the debt situation? I can see they have 3.3 billion net debt, so they run a pretty sizable leverage relative to their operating profit, which luckily is growing and probably very stable because of the subscription model. But I'll let you talk about that. And then secondly, last night we had earnings from we had the from Bumble, which is this alternative, which is, you know, the notion or perception is that, you know, it's a different experience for women in this whole Me Too age. And can you just talk about those two things?
Sure. So that first and foremost, the nature of the product, mainly being subscription, it kind of alleviates some of my concerns there. They have in the past been, you know, great at kind of restructuring debt. I think I only read it a couple of days ago, but off the top of my head, the 2022 kind of exchangeable notes were dealt with in Q3. Off the top of my head, because I don't have the numbers in front of me, the next kind of maturity after that is somewhere around 2025, 2026. So, you know, there's a good runway there in a period that we're expecting margin expansion, you know, greater free cash flow, revenue to continue to trickle along there. Just the nature of the revenue, subscription based, is higher quality than, you know, maybe something that's a bit more cyclical. So for debt, not overly concerned. I don't mind a company using a bit of leverage there. The second question related to Bumble. No, it's an interesting one. I do like Bumble as a product, maybe not so much the company, but I was invested in Match Group long before Bumble became public. So it's partly, you know, why I'm in Bumble, in Match Group. The product itself. So I've done a bit of product testing here, purely just kind of hands-on, created an account on multiple sites and then positioned it in a way where I'm purely just here to kind of ask questions and a surprising number of responses. And I would ask similar questions on both platforms. You know, why are you using this one? Why are you using that one? You know, a lot of the women surprisingly weren't so interested in the feature of women asking or starting the conversation, which surprised me. And the reality of the situation is that, and evidence will kind of back this up, that for most young people, you know, in ages of kind of 20 to the mid 30s, they're using a multitude of apps. It's not, I will use Tinder or I will use Bumble. It's, I will use Tinder, Hinge, Bumble, and, you know, whichever other app kind of appeals to me. So the big question and the quote unquote battle between these two companies, one more of a conglomerate, one more of just kind of, you know, there's two companies in there with one being the flagship Bumble, is who is going to drive propensity to pay more so than who has the most users? Because in reality, someone that has a Bumble account likely has a Tinder account or a Hinge account. So I think the positioning here is like, how, you know, which one is better at driving people to pay for the service? Because whilst it's likely you'll have multiple dating apps, it's unlikely you're going to be paying tooth and nail to have premium subscriptions on each one.
Good answers, I think. I mean, in terms of valuation, you're paying significantly more to get access to the Match Group growth journey from here on. I mean, what's your expectations for what returns can Match Group deliver to investors from the current levels and, you know, over the next 4 or 5 years? I mean, what should, just to get a sense of your expectation.
I think certainly there's better prices. So when I'm talking about Match Group here, I'm talking about the business as a whole. And there's obviously a big difference between, you know, being a business analyst and then being a security analyst. I think Match Group, certainly you're paying a premium to own that bucket of companies. And it's, you know, it's been trading at that for most of the year. So from this point, does it beat the market? I think yes, but is there a better kind of entry point? Definitely, for sure. I think you could find a more attractive valuation for Match Group if you're just patient.
Right. I hope everyone will agree with me that has listened to this podcast that you are very smart and intelligent guy, Connor. You can just hear that you go very deep in these companies, and you sound like someone that has both feet on the ground. I can really encourage anyone that is interested in equities and listening to this podcast to check Connor out on investmenttalk.substack.com. And I think you can read some of your stuff for free, and then going forward, there's also a, you know, a purple button there that says subscribe. So I guess that's the main entry. And then of course they can follow you on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Just, you know, final two questions before we end this podcast. It has been a great conversation, Connor. I mean, so what are your thoughts about, you know, the overall equity market? I know you tend to focus on these specific companies, but what's your thoughts on the overall equity market? And then finally, I mean, To me, you sound very intelligent. Is you, what are your plans to maybe become a portfolio manager in the future or something like that?
Sure. So first question, can it appear? I just don't know. And I'm quite comfortable saying that with respect to what the equity market is going to do in the next year or two. You know, with my econ background, I do like to keep a kind of an eye on the higher level micro environment and try to filter that through. But most of that doesn't really kind of affect my investment process, you know, whether in a good way or a detrimental way. That's for me to kind of figure out and learn. I generally think if anyone wants to get an expert's opinion, they should listen to the Saxo Market Call every morning. I've been doing so for a number of years now, so I'm not just biased because I'm here. You know, it's really genuinely helped me keep track of things that I just simply don't have the time to monitor. It's just kind of your morning snippet of news that's kind of high signal, favors that over noise. So that would be my advice to anyone listening, because my advice is not great in that respect.
Thank you very much.
The second question related to being a portfolio manager long term, this was my initial kind of goal. So I took a role in the fintech space purely because that was just like one rung on the ladder to kind of getting into fund management. I started the CFA designation, started kind of taking investing more seriously, and that was kind of the goal. And then, you know, 2020 just changed so many things for me. So I found that I enjoyed working from home at my own pace, under my own discretion. You know, it meant I had more time to be with my partner who also works from home, and having more freedom during the day. You know, that's just hard to give up when you've kind of been given it on a plate. So right now I'm certainly happy doing what I'm doing, and I'm excited to see where this goes over the next few years. I wouldn't rule it out, but yeah, I think for now I'm just happy doing what I'm doing.
Excellent. Excellent, Connor. It has been an absolute pleasure to having you on this this podcast. A very great conversation. I really hope a lot of our clients will give Connor and basically some of the other independent research persons mm-hmm. out there on Substack. I think it's a treasure of information and knowledge, and can really improve your investments and the goals you have for your portfolios. So with that said, Connor, thank you so much for being on the podcast, and I hope everyone out there that have been listening to it have enjoyed it, and hopefully we can have you back in the future with maybe talking about some other companies.
I would love that. Thank you for the opportunity, Pierre. It's been great.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call, or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.